Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to Loose Units, The Shadow Files. On the 11th of January 1965, two young girls went missing on a beach called Wanda Beach, and it was near Cronulla in Sydney, New South Wales. They were both 15 years old, they were both from West Ryde, and the way their bodies were found, it's been described as the crime which robbed Australia of its innocence. And whether or not that's true, and it is something of a poetic assertion, this week we are looking at the Wanda Beach murders. Dad, I didn't actually know about this crime until you alerted me to it, and God, it is absolutely awful. Why did you want to pick this story for this week?
I love beaches. I've always loved the remoteness of some beaches. I mean, let's face it, Australia is surrounded by beautiful beaches. Mm-hmm. Back in the 1960s, this particular beach, which is sort of north of Cronulla. Mm-hmm. So for people that don't know, you know, what we're talking about or where we're talking about, it might be a good idea to have a look at some maps, no matter where you are in the world, to sort of get a sense of it, you know, its location in terms of, you know, Sydney. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a great divide in Sydney about, you know, which beaches are the best beaches. You've got people on the northern beaches from Manly to Palm Beach, mm-hmm. where your kids are.
That's where we grew up.
Where you grew up.
Yep.
You spent your whole life, well, up until a certain point. And then you've got the eastern suburbs. You've got the famous Bondi Beach, where most people from overseas will come to Bondi Beach. And the reigning king... Is he a king yet?
Who?
The reigning, you know, the guy that's about to become the King of England.
Oh, Charles, yeah, no, I don't know if he's been... The coronation is coming up. Oh,
okay, cool. So, but when he is king, mm-hmm. there's a very famous photograph of him on Bondi Beach, running out of the water and some girl, you know... Anyway, I'm just saying that when most people come to Sydney, they go to Bondi Beach.
Okay.
And I was running on Bondi Beach this morning and... Paul, we're in our fifth year, mm-hmm. and I contacted you, and I literally couldn't believe we've never touched on this story. I had to actually do some internal Loose Units research, because this is the first sort of serious story for this year, isn't it? This is kind of.
I mean, it's a terrible crime. I didn't actually know about it. Forgive me, Dave, but what year were you born?
1960. So
okay. So you were a five-year-old when this happened.
I was five, and I was living in Armidale. And I'll tell you now, mm-hmm. for those that don't know, and I'm stating the bleeding obvious, but it's really important that I say this from the outset. Sydney and the world... was a completely different time, evident by the fact that the two girls, the unfortunate victims of this horrendous unsolved crime.
Yeah, Marianne Schmidt and Christine Sharrock were their names.
That's right, and they were best friends.
Mm.
They were 15, and they lived in Ryde. Now, your mother lived in Ryde, Paul, which is not incredibly exciting. Suffice to say that Christine actually lived in Ryde during this time. And we used to have these trains. I was thinking about this while I was pounding the sand on Bondi Beach this morning. Now, I know that I do become mildly obsessed, sort of obsessed with our stories.
Yeah.
But there's something about this story that I find very unsettling. And I said to Christine this morning that this story has affected me greatly, but I can't pinpoint the reason why.
Well, just in the abstract, I mean, Australian beach culture is a really big part of our identity. And I don't know, I never really associate the beach with crime, but how often do bodies wash up on the beach? How often are bodies found on the beach? Is this a...
regular?
Was it only a matter of time before this happened?
One has to also consider, Paul and listeners, that there are many, many crimes that have been committed where they've never found the bodies.
Right.
It's not out of the question, particularly with sand hills that are continually moving, to bury a body and, you know, over time, the sand dunes just take over, increase in height. And then, of course, you have, because they're protected areas, and rightfully so. Mm. You know, you don't just go and mine, although it happens up north, but generally speaking, they're untouched. And then you get sort of vegetation. So who knows what's underneath the ground, so to speak. But I wanted to touch on these trains that were called the Red Rattlers. The reason they were called Red Rattlers is that they were sort of a reddish burgundy colour and they rattled. And I don't know whether anyone actually can remember train doors that you physically had to... And these are doors that were up to 100 years old. I mean, we're talking early 20th century. Mm-hmm. They had a big bronze sort of lever and you had to literally press the lever down and use all your strength. I mean, how a kid would do it is beyond me. Open the door to get out of the train. And the seats were incredibly hard, uncomfortable, green vinyl. These children, so it's the two 15-year-old girls and then siblings. And, you know, the kids ranged in age from 10 down to 5. It's a big trip. They had to get permission from the grandmother because one of the girls' mother had to go into hospital. So she's actually in hospital. And the grandmother reluctantly sort of... it's a big thing to sort of let these kids travel 2 hours to Cronulla Beach. From Ryde, Cronulla Beach was the only beach they could get to. Now, they had to firstly go to a suburb in Sydney called Redfern, which is fairly notorious, let's say that.
It has been gentrified a lot.
It has.
By now, but I'm guessing back in the 60s it was a little bit dangerous.
You know, there were parts of Redfern when I was a police officer and when I was a firefighter. There were streets in Redfern, listeners, in the 80s and 90s that had signs saying... well, basically, if you were in the fire brigade or the ambulance and you had to attend a job in certain streets in Redfern, you had to wait for police backup.
Right, okay.
Like, and it was... it's another world. So they'd get the train to Redfern, then you can imagine there were 6 kids. I mean, it's just... and they had a £1 note. That's what they were given, which is not a tiny amount of money because it's pre-decimalisation, which happened the following year in 1966. Right. They make their way to Cronulla. What happened was the day before they went to Cronulla, the weather was very bad. So it was cancelled for a day. Mm-hmm. Then they catch the train, get off at Cronulla, walk down onto the beach, and the weather was bad. It was windy, big seas, and they were kind of... well, one can surmise after making that incredible 2-hour journey that, you know, they're a little bit sort of peeved. So one of the young boys actually basically insisted that he be allowed to go for a swim. So one of the girls took him for a swim then they started to make their way north of the Cronulla Surf Club, and they made their way up towards Wanda. So in Australia, we've got these incredibly long beaches. Manly Beach is a good example. You can stand at one end of the beach and you can clearly see 1.5 kilometres away the other end of the beach. But within that beach, you've got three surf clubs.
Yes.
And Manly, case in point, you've got Manly at the southern end in the middle. You've got North Stain. And at the end, you've got Queenscliff. So listeners, whilst you might be sort of traversing distance, you are actually going into different beaches that are controlled by different surf clubs.
So geographically, it looks like one distinct beach, but actually it's three completely separate entities. Really.
With autonomous life-saving groups. And they're very territorial.
Well, also, it would be impossible for one group to, you know, police that much.
That's right. Good point.
Yeah, okay.
But this beach is, it's windswept. It looks across to the airport. It looks across to Kurnell, where they keep, where the big oil refinery storage facility is.
Yep.
What happened was they got all their belongings and they basically left them in a sort of rocky area because there weren't many people around. And they then sought refuge behind the sandhills from the wind. It would have been a very sort of a major sort of onshore wind creating big waves, very loud, very noisy. And you know, Paul, you've been on a beach where it's incredibly windy and the sand's being whipped up. It's sort of like, you know, cutting through your ankles. And the best thing that they could do was get over one of the sandhills.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it's like a massive windbreak. There they took shelter. And it's at this point that the two girls said that they were going to go back and get the belongings for the four kids.
Yeah.
So the kids knew that the belongings were south of where they were.
Okay.
Because they'd been walking north. But weirdly, this is when the story starts to go absolutely crazy. The two girls, the 15-year-old, started walking north. And one of the boys shouted out and said, "You're going in the wrong direction." And they turned around and laughed and kept going. That's the last time any of the children saw their sister and her best friend.
Ugh.
Those children sat in the sandhills, the sand dunes, for almost 5 hours. The youngest one being 5, the oldest being 10. They waited for their sister and her best friend. Can you imagine? They had the presence of mind to realise that at 6 p.m. that fateful evening, the last train headed out of Cronulla to get them to Redfern and then to get home to ride. And those kids, at 5 o'clock, they left. They went down, they travelled down south, they found all the belongings that the sisters had basically left in a relatively safe place, including their purses, which is bizarre. They gathered up all the belongings and they went home. So there lies the beginning of a tragedy.
God, that's stressful. Okay.
The next day,
yep.
A gentleman with his nephews are walking around the sand hills, sand dunes, and it's a common thread, Paul, in a lot of our stories where you read the first account and it's most often the case where the person that sees the body or bodies describes them as store mannequins. Because Wanda Beach back in the 60s was basically a tip. That sounds a little bit hard to believe because now it's a pristine location in Sydney's south. But it was a place where people used to dump cars. They used to dump old corrugated iron, bottles, old toys, just stuff. It was littered with rubbish. And this gentleman saw a leg sticking out of the sand.
Mm-hmm.
He goes up to the leg and he realizes that it is in fact a body. He makes his way to Cronulla Surf Club.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a caretaker there and he explains what he's seen. They call the local police and the police rock up. They go back to the scene and then they begin to realize that unfortunately, with just a very, very little bit of sort of looking around, that it's actually two bodies. And then they began to realize the gravity of the wounds inflicted.
Yeah.
And then very interestingly, they discover a 35-meter track. And every 3 meters, and this is really important, it's one of those points that I've been thinking about since I started investigating this case, and it's problematic, as you will begin to realize, because what they realized, that it's basically a 35-meter trail of blood, but every 3 meters, there's a pooling of the blood. Now, what does that indicate to you?
That the whatever happened was happening in fits and starts. Does that mean someone was trying to escape, stopping, and then continuing further, or does it mean...
Very, very... Good analogy.
Did the crime occur in increments? I don't know.
Well, it's you're on the kind of the right track, but what they've realized upon once it started to become a major investigation was that one of the girls was being murdered, stabbed incredibly, like at the most unbelievable number of times, frenzied. But also the second victim managed to escape. She got as far as 35 metres from the crime scene.
Right.
She'd been pursued by the offenders. I think this is something that I've not heard postulated at all, but there may have been one more, may have been more than one offender.
Yeah.
She was then knocked to the ground. She would have undergone incredible injuries, bleeding profusely.
Mm.
And every 3 meters or so. So she was dragged back 35 meters through the sand, which is an incredible distance. And they're saying, the police, one of the theories is that maybe the person was not a big, strong person, and maybe they, found it incredibly demanding dragging a dead or possibly, unconscious teenage girl through the sand. So every time they'd stop for rest, she'd bleed out.
Right.
Until they got back to the first victim. Now, I have read a lot about this case and, it's difficult. I've got so many thoughts sort of rolling around in my mind. The injuries were appalling, but they found semen. Now, they found it on the bodies. I've read various reports to say that their hymens were intact, which generally indicates no intercourse.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Was it a case of the murderer or murderers committing these vile acts? And then,
I know. It's,
or you know, did that happen after? Did the offenders? Did they? You know, there's no sort of polite way of putting it, but
yeah.
Now they had their pants cut, removed. They both had incredible scratches on their faces, which can indicate, you know, extreme, you know, sort of fighting, I guess. I mean, you can't imagine what it must be like. But there's a lot more to this story, Paul. Look, one of the really interesting things, let's just say that it became one of the biggest police investigations in New South Wales history. Do you know how many people were interviewed during this case, Paul?
I'm guessing a lot. And you said something interesting before, just quickly, because it is two 15-year-old girls, and it seems difficult to me to believe that one person could corral two girls unless there was some... I'm guessing, were they casting a really wide net? Did they have suspects in mind from the beginning?
Look, they interviewed more than 7,000 people.
Oh my God, okay.
Making it the largest investigation in Australian history.
Oh my God.
Like, it's just unbelievable. Totally unsolved.
Mm-hmm.
But this is when it starts. If it's not interesting and fascinating and bizarre enough at this stage, this is really interesting. Neither of the girls consumed alcohol. It was not their thing. They were really, dare I say it, it's a term used, let's just pull this term out of the 60s, but I'm going to describe them as, they were good girls. They were just decent. They, you know, there's been lots of research done. You know, they were just good. They didn't drink. I'm not saying drinking's really bad, evil, blah, 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 but it becomes very important because during the post-mortem, this is just bizarre, one of the girls had a blood alcohol content of 0.015. Which in today's language is almost three times the legal limit. One of them. But in her stomach during the post-mortem, do you know what they found inside her stomach, Paul?
No, I don't.
Okay, they found cabbage and celery. That's all.
I don't know what that means.
I'll tell you what it means. Have you heard of a Chico roll?
Oh my God, yes. It's for those of you outside of Australia, a Chico roll is an iconic sort of service station grade deep fried kind of like a really bad big spring roll, but yes.
Okay, although they were, I can remember the package that they'd slide the knobby type.
It's like this waxy paper with Chico written on it.
Yeah, and they'd just drop it in.
These things are iconic.
It was sort of the inverted kind of putting a condom on.
I haven't seen one for well over a decade, by the way.
But they were big time in the 60s and 70s.
Mm-hmm, very.
So how did possibly the contents of a Chico roll end up in one of the girls' stomach?
It's a good question.
It is a very, very good question. And what about the alcohol? So let's just now put on our detective caps. The girls met at least one person.
Right.
Was it prearranged? In my opinion, no.
Okay, so it wasn't that they went there with the kids under the pretext of, look, when we've got the kids over, we're just going to sneak off and hang out with some guys. That's not what you think.
Jumping ahead,
mm-hmm.
The police, when they went to the girls' bedrooms,
yes,
discovered diaries and discovered that they actually had met two boys at the same location or in that vicinity and actually kissed them. So that's kind of interesting. But it just doesn't, to me, ring true that they'd meet two boys, kiss them, they thought they were kind of nice, they go back and then they get murdered. That's... because if that's the case, then you're talking two... probably two young boys. That I don't think two boys just become rabid murderers sort of overnight. Yeah. With these cases, there's a lot of prehistory. Lots of things. You know, you can talk to criminal psychologists and get a good understanding. But I don't think that's the case. I think they've walked away from the girl, you know, the siblings, kind of left them there. Maybe just gone for a walk. You know, maybe they met up with a young person but was working in conjunction with an older person who did definitely have nefarious thoughts. I mean, the temptation, if you're a deviant sort of predator, if you get two girls by themselves, and as the police said later on, you could scream until the cows came home and no one could hear you because you're behind a sand dune. No one on the ocean side can hear you because of the waves. It was the perfect place if you wanted to kill someone to do it and then bury their bodies easily because it's sand. You know, but the fact that there's food inside the stomach, there's alcohol in one of the girls, makes you then think that they actually spent some time. I mean, obviously, because they know with the food in the stomach that food was in the stomach up to 1 hour prior to death because it had not been digested, but they knew it had been consumed. So the mother of one of the girls was in hospital and her son came to see the mother and let her know this unfolding tragedy. And he actually spoke to the mother that night. This is before they'd found the girls. And the mother, weirdly, in a prophetic sense, said to the son, I don't think they're ever going to come home. Like she had this feeling and then it all became, you know, revealed. And tragically, one of the brothers who was, you know, a young boy, and this will sort of shock a lot of listeners. It certainly shocked me and I found it very upsetting. But then I think, you know, back in those days, things were very different. But one of the siblings asked the police, could he please see the crime photos. And the police showed the young boy the photos of the two girls, including the fact that one of the girls had a knife wound to her throat that almost severed her head. And this poor young boy got to see the photographs. I think that's... I don't know what to say.
I got to ask, how were the girls killed specifically, and what kind of state were their bodies in when they were found? You mentioned scratches, but how were they actually killed?
They both had multiple stab wounds.
Okay.
They had severe head injuries, skulls crushed. One of the girls had her throat slit so badly that, according to the boy, mm-hmm. I have gone through the Australian Police Journal, through all the annals. I can't find anything on this case.
Oh, that's interesting.
It's interesting. I just don't get it. I don't understand how one of the most famous cases in Australian history. There would not be many people in Sydney that have not heard of the Wanda Beach murders. Mm. Now, there was a fireman with his nephews, allegedly, according to all the reports, he was the last person to see the girls. He saw them walking. And when I joined the New South Wales Fire Brigades, he was a very, very senior officer in the New South Wales Fire Brigades.
Right.
And the legend, the chat in the fire brigade at the time, was that he was actually a suspect. But I refute that because I've actually done the research. He was not a suspect. But like in any organisation, whether, you know, the fire brigade's a great example where people have got lots of free time, you know, these sort of legends and rumours grow. And I think that's really unfortunate for this particular officer in the fire brigade.
Mm-hmm.
How he'd gone from, you know, being the last person, you know, with members of his family to see the girls in the dunes, which would have been very unnerving, but he was about 800 metres away from them. He says that they were hurrying through the sand dunes and they were continually looking behind them as though they were being followed or pursued. Isn't that incredible?
Yeah.
And he was a very reliable witness. And there were various people. The problem with that particular area is that, and I'm sort of making a sort of a rather blanket statement, but I'm just going to put it out there, and that is that it was frequented by some pretty unusual people, some perverts, people that used to be, you know, masturbate while people were having sex.
You're saying weird shit, like weird dodgy shit happened on these dunes all the time.
On the dunes, all the time. Plus, it was a rubbish tip. Plus, which made it really, really difficult to look for evidence. And, you know, they found this tiny bit of a blade, a broken blade, and it actually had blood on it. And it could have been the case that, you know, the offender used a knife, either that they'd brought with them or it had been found in the dunes, but the frenzied attack actually broke off part of the knife. And then I was sitting last night thinking about the force required to drive a knife into someone and then actually break the knife off.
Right.
It's just, it's terrible. But what one of the terrible parts of this particular case is that they had, you know, the police had very, very valuable physical evidence,
mm-hmm.
bearing in mind that back in the 1960s, they did not even know about DNA evidence. It just wasn't a thing.
Yeah. And so, you look at the police officers at this crime scene. I've actually got a photo here, and you can see bits and pieces of their bodies sort of jutting out of the sand. And I can see now how somebody stumbled across this and did think it was, you know, bits of a mannequin. But there's a line of about, I would say, 12 police officers, some detectives, some, I would say, general duties. And it's just a different era. I cannot imagine this era of cops having anything approaching sophisticated forensic methods. Is that a fair assumption?
I think that's reasonable, Paul.
Yeah.
You know, they brought in some heavy equipment. They set up some big sieves. They actually had undercover police dressed in bathers lurking in the sandhills.
Now, is that because typically the murderer will occasionally return to the scene of a crime and they hoped they'd get someone coming back to check it out?
Yeah, they just wanted to, you know, sort of get some leads or even talk to people. That the problem, one of the problems in this case is that because it was an area of sort of ill repute, which was frequented by lots and lots of people, the problem there is that when the police are trying to get information, no one wants to come forward because they don't want to be perceived as having been in that area for nefarious reasons. So if you are a compulsive masturbator, or you are a nudist, or you're, you know, this was a, and I'm just going to use a term that, yes, listeners, I know it's not PC today, but back in the 60s, this was a haunt for, you know, various people. So there were all sorts of things happening there, and people would have seen things. There's no denying that. But unfortunately, because of the nature of the types of people, even if you were fossicking for Australian fauna, can you imagine going to the local police station and saying, "Hi, look, I was looking for, you know, rare plant species up in the dunes." The police, well, a lot of the police, and probably more so back then, would just go, "Yeah, right, you're..." So I feel that a lot of information was lost.
Okay, well, you know, they say that the phrase cold case rarely applies more than now when, you know, so much time has passed and memory gets weird. Don't get me wrong, I'm looking at photos from the 12th of January 1965, the day after the bodies were found. And, you know, there's investigation photos, there's still records. Getty Images is full of black and white pictures of this stuff. It is... there are historical records being kept. But that doesn't mean that memory doesn't fade and that things don't get a little bit difficult the longer time passes.
Paul, they offered a reward that was the equivalent of about $500,000.
Right.
Do
those ever work, by the way? Do those ever bring out accurate information?
Yes, they do. But this one, no. Now, listen, it's important, listeners and Paul, to be aware that there were three main suspects.
Okay.
And I think next week, Paul,
we can look at them?
We can look at the three suspects. Now, one of the suspects...
yeah.
Who was really fucking heavy duty, he went on to become in the top 10 wanted by the FBI and became a notorious mass murderer.
Oh my God. Okay, so we've got some stuff to really sink our teeth into next week.
Big time.
Oh, wow. Okay, I did not expect this to be such an intricate murder. And next week, I also want to delve into the assertion that this is when Australia lost its innocence, because, I mean, that is the kind of poetic headline that papers would love to run with. But maybe it's true. I don't know, but we'll figure that out next week on Loose Units, The Shadow Files. Also, Dad, coming up later this week on Loose Ends, we have received another anonymous tip about the so-called Darlow book.
Bloody hell.
A big one. So,
Paul,
strap in.
Mate.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah, I know.
I didn't
know that. No. No, it arrived very late from an anonymous email address on the Loose Units email account. And let's just say we've got a lot of stuff to talk about. This podcast is escalating in a way that is very interesting and kind of stressful. So we're really happy that you're all with us twice a week, every week. So please tell your friends, tell your family to listen, grab the books. If we had merch, we'd ask you to buy it. Really, we're just so excited to have you back for 2023. It's really wonderful to be back in the driver's seats doing Loose Units, the Shadow Files.
You don't drive.
Well, you know, give me one of those little plastic wheels so I can pretend to drive next to you.
Cool.
Yeah, great. Well, that's another episode of Loose Units, the Shadow Files. I'm Paul, that's John, and we will see you this week, later this week, for more Loose Units. Bye-bye, everyone.
Cheerio.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.